This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Cheech Marin. Cheech was born in South Los Angeles. His family was tight-knit. What mattered to them was making sure Cheech went to school and got right with God. By the time he was in eighth grade, his plan was to become a priest. But that, well, that was before he tried smoking weed. Now, he didn't actually try it until he went away to college. It was a new world for him. Living away from home with friends. One night, somebody passed him a joint. It was the 60s. He got turned on. Not just to smoking pot, but eventually to the peace movement and the movement for Chicano civil rights. And at that point, becoming a priest wasn't really on the agenda. He was an artist. He met Tommy Chong, they started a double act, and the rest is history. Stoner history.
Mexican Americans don't like to just get into gang fights. They like flowers and music and white girls named Debbie too. Mexican Americans are named Chata and Chela and Chema and have a son-in-law named Jeff.
Of course, Cheech Marin isn't just half of Cheech and Chong. He was in The Lion King. He made 122 episodes of Nash Bridges. He was even, for a little while, the star of a Golden Girls spinoff. And let me tell you, if you are the right age for the Spy Kids movies, he will always be fake Uncle Felix.
What are you talking about?
I was assigned to protect your family, but something's gone wrong. I have to take you to the safe house.
My parents can't be spies. They're not cool enough.
That's cool.
Cheech is also a collector of Chicano art, probably the most prolific and significant collector in the world. He's been building up his treasure trove since the 80s, and now it's so large that he's opened his own museum, the Cheech Marin Center for Chicano Art and Culture in Riverside. He says you should call it the Cheech. Marin, of course, is also still acting. He's got a part in the new comedy, Champions, that's in theaters now, and he also just played alongside Jennifer Lopez in the movie Shotgun Wedding. That's about a couple and their families who've come together for the ultimate destination wedding. Only then, the bride and groom start to get cold feet. And also, the wedding is invaded by pirates. Here's a little bit of Shotgun Wedding. The pirates have taken captives, they have a list of demands, and the captives, well, I guess the captives have a counteroffer? Anyway, you'll hear Carol, she's the mother of the groom, played by Jennifer Coolidge, and Robert, who's the father of the bride, played by my guest, Cheech Marin.
Robert, he's calling you again.
Thanks, Carol. Okay, what do you want?
Well, we call my colleague on the satellite phone, and you transfer $45 million to a bank account.
I don't have that kind of money.
We Googled you. Net worth is $60 million.
I'm not giving you anything until I find out if my daughter's safe.
And your son-in-law.
Yeah, him too.
Cheech Marin, welcome to Bullseye. So happy to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And congratulations on being America's film and television dad, these past, at this point, like 35 years.
you're really shocked into reality when my agent called me for this movie. She says, J-Lo wants you to be her daddy. So really? I'll see if I can squeeze her in, but, you know, I'm married and everything. No, her father, you moron. And so J-Lo's father now. So that's great.
Do you tire of smiling gently at children and grandchildren in films and television?
Not at all. You know, I love it. You know, I live, you know, every age has its golden spot, you know, and the longer you live, the sweeter that spot gets, you know, for me anyways.
I mean, Champions is also a very sweet movie and you get to be very sweet and it's nice to watch you do it. It's the same with all those like the Spy Kids movies.
Yeah.
Like, I hadn't watched those Spy Kids movies as a kid because I was just a little too old for it. But then my kids got into them. They're so pleasant and fun.
You know?
They're just such a pleasant vibe.
And they're smart and funny. I met Robert Rodriguez a long time ago. And he was still in college where he just made his first film, Mariachi, which was, you know, a student film. And so I had this thing out that I was reminded of today. Cheech the Bus Driver was a record, and it was children's stuff. And so there was a lot of interest in some studios of making something, you know, with an animated or a movie. And so I says, they came to me and said, well, who would you like to direct this? And I said, Robert Rodriguez. And they looked at me and said, are you out of your mind? He's all blood and guts. I said, no. He has
the guy with the machine gun and the violin case?
You know, blows your head off? No. And I said, he has this other side of him that's just children's standing. Get out of it. Because that's the first thing I ever saw when I met him. He showed me this little film he made. It was a student film with his brothers and sisters. And it was called Bedhead. And it was like, it was Spy Kids. You know, but nobody ever saw it. And so after Spy Kids came out, and I said, so who's laughing now?
You're originally from Los Angeles. You grew up in South LA and the Valley, right?
Yeah, half and half.
Which half and which half?
South Central, 36 in San Pedro, if you want to go look it up, for the first half until I was...
Can I just give a shout out to all people that give their intersection when they... Because I'm like 15th and Guerrero. Like,
yeah,
immediately. Like,
you know
where are you from? 15th and Guerrero.
Boy, you know, and that's a way to specifically identify it. You know, because when I was first out on with Cheech and Chong, and he'd be in other parts of the country, and they would ask me that same, where'd you grow up? And but well, South Central. So you mean like Watts? And so that was their concept of yeah, Watts. It's just a shortcut to say yeah, it was all black neighborhood. And so later on, you know, when I came to do in movies, and there would be some reporters, oh yeah, what part of South Central are you from? 36 in San Pedro. Oh. You get it, you know. Now it was all mostly all black then, and now it's all Salvadorian, and then we moved from there to Granada Hills in the San Fernando Valley, and so one day everybody was black, and then the next day everybody was white, and I was a Chicano in both, you know. So how do you navigate that? You try to be nice to everybody.
Did your family have a relationship to the Chicano culture in LA that was already really vibrant? Like there was plenty of Mexicans born in America.
Yeah. It was called my family.
Yeah.
What kind of community? I had 63 cousins, you know, or something like, I mean, it was, you know, but I went to all black schools and Trinity Street School. I don't know if you know.
But like, was there like masa at the grocery store?
Oh, yeah.
By your house?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, there was. You had to go find it, but mostly you didn't want to find it there. You wanted to find it in East Los or someplace like that.
Your father was a police officer, right?
He was. 30 years, LAPD.
What was it like to have a dad who was a police officer in, let's say, turbulent times?
Well, it was good and bad, you know. It's like he used it for like, well, my dad's a cop and he can throw you in jail when you're a little kid to, you know, there was always a lot of angst in the neighborhood being a Chicano cop in an all-black neighborhood. So, but, you know, you got to see the police department really up close because I grew up at the police academy and you saw that there was good guys and bad guys, you know, overwhelmingly good guys. You know, they were doing their job and they were – but that was kind of my family's profession. They were either law enforcement or clergy. So I don't know.
Were you a goody two-shoes?
Pretty much, yeah. I was an altar boy. I was in the choir. I got the religion award. I was headed for the priesthood. I was going to the junior seminary in Montebello. I was going to be a diocesan priest or Vincentian priest. And I started going to parties after I graduated from eighth grade that summer. And I said, wait a minute, let me get
You were – hold up. You were headed for the priesthood when you were in eighth grade?
About to go to high school, yeah. The junior seminary I was supposed to go.
I didn't know there was a – that's like under-18s basketball.
No. The junior seminary is where you went to
– like JROTC or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. That, but for a priest, you know. And many members of my family did that. And
were you doing it because of how much you loved God or because it was just – you were just rolling down that hill?
It was mostly that, you know. I was just rolling down the hill. But I was very religious. I mean, I was an altar boy and choir. I sang in the choir and all this. And I got the – that was a big deal. I got the religion award. So they were like almost being pushed in that direction. And my cousins were either priests or nuns. Or had gone to the junior seminary, went on to be priests, and you know, so it was fairly usual because I don't know if anybody else had this experience, but in Catholic school they drill that into you every day that you're going to get a vocation and wait for the God's going to talk to you and you're going to be a priest, and they drilled it into you every day.
Well, I mean, I also imagine. I mean, I'm speaking for you here, but perhaps you never heard the call.
No, it was more like an echo.
From your cousin's house?
Oh, yeah. They were all – both of my older cousins, Louis and Regine, they went to the Franciscan Junior Seminary in Santa Barbara, and they were going to be a Franciscan priest until they both dropped out. Regine actually went all 4 years, and he was a student body president. He was headed for the priesthood, and he dropped out. Eventually, he landed in Harvard on a full scholarship and became the first PhD in Chicano studies from Harvard University. So there was a real fast crowd that I was you know, running with, and that's how I got all my education and everything.
So when you started getting into partying, I guess it must have been the mid-60s, huh?
Sure. When did I go to school? Yeah, that was when I was in college.
Okay.
In mid-60s.
So the early 60s then. So what was the scene like in the early 60s? My dad lived in Glendale, mm-hmm. and I found out as an adult that his main thing – he went to Berkeley. He was an A student. His main thing was doing speed and stealing his parents' car, driving to the beach from Glendale – partying at the beach all night, then driving back in the morning before his parents woke up and going to school.
That's living on the line.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was a policeman, you know, and I feared death more than I feared.
Yeah, I don't know if my CPA grandfather really could have.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was very clear what the expectancy was, you know. So, no, I was a really strict guy. We were very academic kids. We all went to Catholic school. And so the oldest cousin, Louis, formed us in a little group and basically started what came to be AP classes. And he assigned each one of us topics to go learn about and bring back to the group. And I got assigned art. That's how I learned about art from there. So, well, how do you do that? You go to the library and you take out all the library. You don't even take out the library books because they wouldn't let a kid take them out, but they would bring them in front of me and then turn them over page by page. And that's how I learned about Western art.
So, okay. So tell me what leaving the straight and narrow meant for you. Like, at what point did you deviate from this path of this family home study group, this ad hoc home study group that you were doing and the going to the junior priest school and everything?
As soon as I could. I mean, really, you know, like I was finally off the leash. You know, I was in college and I was living in an apartment with a bunch of guys. And I came home one night and there was a party going on. That wasn't unusual. There was always parties going on. And very smoky in the apartment. And my roommate handed me this cigarette. And I said, what is this? You know, I don't smoke. And so I says, no, man, it's a joint. What's a joint?
You're doing a bit here. You knew what a joint was.
I didn't know what a joint was. The only thing I know about marijuana is seen it in the newspapers. They were always busting some guy and with a trunk open and a big bale of hay in the back of it. You know, that's, and my dad said, "If you ever do any of this, I will kill you myself." Okay, I believed him, you know, because he was that kind of guy. And I was a very, very, I went to Catholic school all my life, you know, and but then I was off the leash and went to Cal State Northridge. It was Valley State then. It wasn't even Cal State North, it was Valley State. And so he says, "It's a joint, a marijuana." And I go, "Oh." He says, "Try it." I said, "Okay, hey, I'm off the leash." And took a big hit, and then the joint went around the room. And by the time it got to me, back to me, I was high, and I go, "And what else have they been lying about?"
How aware were you in the mid-60s? Mm-hmm. We're talking about before you moved out of the States, which you did, mm-hmm, eventually, which is where you met Tommy Chong. Mm-hmm. How aware were you of the Chicano civil rights movement?
It was just starting. It was the Black civil rights movement that really took over campuses at the time, and SDS. That movement, which had a big strong chapter at Valley State, and because they were all red diaper babies, you know, from their parents that were the commies of their day, you know, and so it was very strong in that campus, and so that's, we had this string of speakers that stopped there and did their speech at our campus, and it was very influential to me. Reyes Tijerina would come, Eldridge Cleaver, Floyd McKissick, but the guy that made the most impression, the biggest impression on me, was David Harris, and he came through with the draft resistance movement, and it just boom, rung a bell with me. Okay, this is the way to go. The universal soldier, don't participate in the thing. And so I joined the draft resistance movement, turned in my draft card, and it went on a speaking tour with David Harris and Joan Baez, his new wife, around the country. And it was on the cover of Newsweek magazine. If you look very closely, you can see my draft card pasted on there in the corner, you know. And so then we all did that. But it coincided at the same time with me discovering pottery.
Really? I took a you know, wheel class. Uh-huh. Shout out to the Barnstall Art Center. And I could not throw a pot. Oh, I could not get that. I could not get that clay to come upright.
Yeah, on
at
center.
At all. Not even close.
It is a craft that you learn if you have enough patience to do it. But once you center your first piece of clay and you put it, it centers you, physically centers you. And I remember that feeling. I want this feeling all the time. And I kept, I gave up. I quit all my other classes, quit my job, got a $900 NEDA loan. I lived on that and then made pottery all day, every day.
I mean, that is a bold move for a dude whose dad is a cop. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I was off the leash. You know, you shouldn't let those kids off the leash if you want them to come back.
Did your family know about what was going on with you? Were you excommunicated? Were you encouraged to spend your days making pottery?
I was disconnected to my family just during that period. My parents were going through a divorce at the same time, so it was like very chaotic, and I was living on my own, and I didn't inform.
I imagine an extra big deal with Catholic parents.
Oh yeah, you know. Because I was supposed to be a priest, and now I'm making pottery. Where did we fail you? You didn't fail me at all. I've learned over the years, is if opportunity presents itself and there's an open door, and you have a second to recognize it and walk through the door, and so if your instincts are trained and honed, you'll walk through the door. And that's what I've done all my life. You know, it's recognizing that the possibility when it presents itself.
Were you already performing at this point?
I was always a performer. I made my first record when I was 5 years old, singing little Mexican songs. Amortito corazón. I had this little squeaky voice, but I could sing in tune. You know, so my mother had this friend who had this little record company, and so I made direct-to-disc recordings of these songs. You know, so I was always, it was natural to me, and I was sang in school, and I was in the choir all the time. So yeah, performing was another part that just came instinctively to me.
What about acting or being funny?
Funny, yeah. I had a very funny family. and they were very quick-witted, and you had to have your A material if you wanted to get any time at the dinner table, you know, to interject your little views of life. And so I had to, you know, compete with a lot of really smart, intelligent, very fast people. And so I honed my skills. So I knew I was funny. I knew I could be funny. And that just, I just took that for granted. And just like I took singing for granted, you know.
We've got more from my conversation with Cheech Marin still to come. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. Support for NPR and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is comedy legend Cheech Marin. Now, Cheech isn't just an actor. He's also an art collector with a huge collection of Chicano art. He's been buying it since the 80s. And at this point, it's way, way more stuff than he could fit on the walls of his house. Or the walls of pretty much any house. So when the Riverside Art Museum told him that there was an empty library in Riverside that they might be able to get into, Marin was listening. They teamed up, and in a few years, they'd built it. The Cheech Marin Center for Chicano Art and Culture. 60,000 square feet of Mexican-American art. They call it, for short, the Cheech. Let's get into the rest of my conversation with Cheech Marin. You moved to Canada because of your objection to the draft mm-hmm. and the war.
But equally, to be a potter.
Is that so?
Yeah. I was in the middle of the draft thing, and they were coming to get us, you know, because Hershey issued this directive that, who was the director of the draft at the time, the directive of anybody who turned in their draft cards or burnt them or protested at the draft would be immediately reclassified, drafted, and sent to the front lines in Vietnam. That was his fix. Good luck on that one. Everybody knew it was a First Amendment issue, and it would be thrown out of court, which it did eventually, but you were going to spend 3 or 4 years in Leavenworth, which is where they were sending everybody to wait their decision. But at the same time, I discovered pottery. And my pottery teacher, Howard Tollison, big shout out to Howard, doing my predicament. He says, well, I have this ex-student who's opening up a pottery in Canada, in Alberta. It's maybe he needs an assistant. That was all I needed. I got on the dog and went to Calgary, Alberta. And, you know, I thought that this was going to – I thought it was going to be like Sergeant Preston in the Yukon. It was going to be met like a sled dog with huskies. And it looked like Bakersfield, you know.
It is pretty – I mean, like, real talk, though. Like, I've been to Calgary. It's pretty Bakersfield.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Canadian Dallas.
Yeah.
Bakersfield, like oil towns, big flat places.
Until you got to the Rockies.
Yeah.
It was flatter than a tortilla there. Yeah. And so, you know, okay, well, this is good. But I met this potter who was a young guy and helped him build his pottery. And when he built it, he couldn't afford to hire me because he was just done. So I says, but I know this other potter. He's actually a very well-known potter living in Bragg Creek. about 11 miles away. Maybe he needs an assistant. And so I got up in the morning, put on my cowboy boots and started walking and hitchhiked a little bit and went up to this, found this guy where his studio was. His name was Ed Drahanchuk. And he had just won the Bicentennial Exhibition Award the year I got there. Pretty famous for pottery. And I walked up to his studio and started talking until he hired me. And so he says, when can you start? I said, I can start right now. He says, okay, start cleaning these bricks over there. And that's what I did and I was in the foothills of the Rockies in the provincial park in Bragg Creek and made pottery.
Did they have masa at the grocery store?
Not at all. They had no masa in. They were stuck with a predicament that all Canadians that I met in this period were stuck with. They looked at me and go, "What are you?" Because they had no idea. Mexicans or Chicanos. Are you Indian or American Indian? Are you East Indian? But they looked at me all the time. Like, what do you speak English? A little bit, Mister. You know, it was funny to me.
So how did you end up leaving the world of making fine art pottery behind in favor of doing a music comedy act, two-hander in strip clubs or whatever?
Oh, that's a natural progression.
Sure.
In this little town, Bragg Creek, that during the winter, there was maybe 10 people who lived there. And they had one restaurant. It was called the Steak Pit. Gordy Schultz and his wife had it. And it was a, you know, steak restaurant. And Gordy was a jazz player. He played bass and his brother, and he played sax, and his brother and his sister-in-law that was had a little dine and dance trio there at the restaurant. And there was the only place to go, first of all. And then I used to go there at night and sing with them because I knew all those tunes, you know, I knew all that. I grew up with them. And so that was great. So, like, I started being, you know, lured into the evil world of show business again. And this trio wanted me to go on tour with them. So we're going to Hawaii next. That's great, but that's in the United States, and I can't go back there because I'm wanted. And so, you know, so I got set up to, I was waiting to be set up with a tour of the Northwest Territories, I guess, you know, me and a guitar and singing songs. But then I was waiting in Banff, in Alberta, and I knew a girl there that I met, and she said, well, you can stay here while you're doing that. And so after a while, she goes, you ever think of getting a job? I go, I've thought about it, but, you know. And so he says, well, they need a fry cook up in Sunshine Village. And so I did that. And I did that until I broke my leg badly skiing because I never, you know, I was skiing for the first time in my life. And speed, who needs to stop, man?
You never skied in South LA?
No, not a bunch. I skated a lot. No. Skated by.
Not even in the valley.
Not even in the valley, man. No, so I compound fractured my leg, and I was like, it was bad, and I was in the hospital for months with a broken leg, you know. So when I got out of there, my roommate in Banff said, hey, well, let's go to Vancouver. That's where I'm from. We'll hang out there and see what's happening. And so eventually I got turned on to Tommy Chong by the editor of this magazine that I was writing for at the time, a rock and roll magazine called Poppin'. And he says, there's this guy, he's doing this weird theater thing in the strip bar in Chinatown. Yeah, sounds good. And so I went down there to check it out, and it was the first strip club in Vancouver. It was the first total naked. I was intrigued, and so I looked at that, and I convinced him that I was this great improv actor from LA and had improvised a resume. And he said, well, that sounds good to me. And he hired me as a writer for this group. And so I started writing for this group, and then I became part of the group. I acted on. So the group fell apart, but it was a real strip bar. I mean, not, you know, like a gentleman's club. No, it was a strip bar, you know. And it was loggers and bikers and, you know, hardcore guys. And we changed the club overnight from a strip bar to naked improv.
What I'm imagining that I'm wrapping my head around is you, a small Chicano man.
Yes.
An American here in Canada. Tommy Chong half white, half Asian Canadian man. Mm-hmm. Both of you long hairs in this strip club. I mean, you must have been space aliens to these. Like, what were you doing that was, what was the thing that you found that could land with people who had come to see you, like when you had gone to see Tommy Chong, and with guys that were coming in to see a strip show?
Naked women.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
it's, you know, the original Upright Citizens Brigade in New York was in a strip club.
Yeah.
But they had closed the strip club before they opened the comedy theater. So it was just people who thought it was still a strip club and were confused. It wasn't people who were also seeing strippers.
Yeah, no, we incorporated it. And what I realized that after a while that what we were really doing was classic burlesque, strippers and comedians, except the comedians in this point were improv actors. And the audience dug it as long as we got to the stripping part eventually, you know, and there was like, oh, and then we started attracting an audience and then we started getting reviewed by the papers, you know, like they didn't like us, but they reviewed us, you know, it took them 2 pages to give us a review. And so we started attracting this audience. And just as we did, everybody in the group quit because they wanted to go to the hills and get their heads together. And I had been to the hills. My head was together. My pocketbook wasn't together. So Tommy calls me after one night and he says, look, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start a duo, me and you. You're a singer. I'm a guitar player. Because he was with Motown for many years. A big hit song too. And he says, we'll do some bits and then we'll play R&B and then we'll do some more bits. And I said, maybe we can get a gig in Vegas in one of the lounges. That sounds good to me, but we had to go back to LA to do that and where I was wanted by the FBI. So it was, you know, a little dicey. So I took all the precautions. I got my friend's photo ID, his driver's license with his picture on it. And then crossed back in the United States and go, okay, Brown, go ahead.
Did you think this was a burlesque act? Like, did you think you were touring like you would have been touring with the jazz band from BAMF singing standards or whatever? Like, did you think you were going to be going and playing lounges and doing something that everyone would like? Or did you think that you were going to be making something that cool people would like that would make you famous comedians?
You know,
which were you shooting for?
I was shooting. Our goal, right when we started, is we had to get our hands on $1.50 every day. That was my goal, because with $1.50, we could make some kind of Chinese meal, beef and greens with rice, and we could live. We could eat. That was our goal, really. And so we went around town, walking around, pulling the little red wagon with us. This is honestly got true. The little to pick up pop bottles in empty lots, and they had a 3-cent deposit or something. At the end of the day, we had $1.50, even if we didn't get a gig. I knew right away that we had something that was different. People reacted to it if they could see it. And so it was eventually we were going to do something with this because it was different than anything else that was out there. And also that when we came back into L.A., we only played black clubs, you know, because that's Tommy knew the black clubs from Motown. And I knew black clubs from having lived there for, you know, so we were doing material that was appealing to that audience, you know, and weed was the commonality.
Yeah. So when did you find that was the theme?
Right away. They didn't know in Canada. They didn't know anything about Chicanos, you know. But the weed, yeah, that really connected. So it wasn't until we got back to L.A.
that the material about the upholstery and lowriders started. Yeah, hitting.
It started. You know exactly that, and so. We were out and we're struggling at first, you know, to kind of connect with the audience. And we were playing a gig out in the valley on Reseda Boulevard, and it was a rock and roll club, and we were doing okay, but it wasn't. And so Tommy and I were standing in front of the club in between shows, and we said, "Well, what are we gonna do?" And this car pulled up. Well, Lord, is, hey man, you know where Reseda Boulevard is? Yeah, you're on it. Hey, I told you. And they took off, and Tommy goes, when we go back in to do the show, the bit in the car with me and you, do it like a Chicano. Do it like these guys. Okay, got it. We went back, and the club stopped I mean, really, this is it. The club stopped. The music stopped. People came from all parts of the club to sit. Yay, rousing reaction. And, okay, this is the direction that we're going in this direction because it's everybody responded to it.
If you as a kid had talked that way, been that way in your household, what would happen?
Nothing, you know. Because it depends on which side of the family. I had a lot of cousins, you know. They're all over the place. But, you know, at least three or four of my uncles were policemen, LAPD. My Uncle Rudy, oh, this is a great story. My Uncle Rudy De Leon, who always was Uncle Rudy, he became the highest ranking Chicano in the force. He was the first captain of Hollenbeck, and they've named the Hollenbeck station after him. It's the Rudy, you see a plaque there if you go, the Rudy de Leon. And it wasn't in typical Chicano fashion. It wasn't until I was in my 40s that I was told that he really wasn't my uncle. Uncle Rudy's not my uncle. You know, all Chicanos are all uncles. They're all your uncle. You know, Robert Rodriguez introduces me to his kids as Uncle Cheech. And, oh, hi, Uncle Cheech, every time I go there. And so it's like, okay, well, it's shifting ground here. But
your parents also, there's a point at which, and I learned this when I visited my stepmother's family in Northern Ireland, where there's a certain number of brothers and sisters that you cannot be expected to be responsible for all of them.
Yep.
You're like, okay, this is 99% this is one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Is this Frank? I think this is Frank.
You never know. And just, okay, you just nod. You know, okay, that's your uncle. Okay, he's my uncle. And I was into my 40s. He's not my uncle. What's going to, the whole world shifted. So okay, we're in that zone right now. Okay. It was okay. You know, but it was eye opening.
Was your gigantic mustache real?
Yeah. When I left Canada and we came back to L.A., I started growing a mustache. And then Tommy and I were together and we were looking for gigs and what to do. And this agent says, well, I got this movie that they're trying to cast and you might be great for it. And so I went in to read for it. And the guy says, you know, it could be, let's see without the mustache. Okay. And so I went home, I shaved off my mustache and he says, I don't think you're right for the part. And I said, well, you, dude. Yeah, that was the last time I had it for the next 40 years, you know.
I got to tell you, I watched Up in Smoke last night, and you look great in that movie.
Oh.
That mustache looks good on you. The hat looks good on you. You even pull off the halter top pretty well.
You know, it came out of observation, what I was seeing. I put together all my own costumes because I would observe what was happening, you know, around that kind of half T-shirt with the red suspenders was my original touch with khakis, you know, high-waisted khakis, mostly to hide my love handles, you know.
You were pretty – honestly, there's a shirtless scene in Up in Smoke, and I was like, look at Cheech. This dude's pretty yoked. This good dude's in good shape.
You know, I was an athlete all my life, too, in addition to all this other stuff. I played every sport and worked out. And Tommy was a bodybuilder. He was a real bodybuilder with all those guys, Schwarzenegger at the Muscle Beach and Dave Draper and all those guys.
What's amazing about that outfit that you wear in that like classic Cheech and Chong Cheech outfit is it's clean. Like, you look good, right? It is also not very far from a clown suit.
Yeah.
Like the red suspenders and the high pants and that, like, it really gives you a form and a shape that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been repeating this lately because I'm kind of coming to the realization of what it was, is that we were both deep and shallow at the same time with the same material. Yeah. And that is the mark of true genius.
And it's like double funny too, just physically with your kind of pachuco cholo lean back, you know, drop back a shoulder.
Uh-huh.
Like it really, what the same thing that makes it cool, right? Yeah. Is funny.
It's funny. Yeah.
You just 5% more of it, and it's funny.
You know, and that is really the truth. You know, and I do it intuitively from observation. I don't like to say, well, what would this guy look like? I just kind of put together what the guy looks like or talks like or walks like, you know. And it was just intuitive to me, like most things. It was what I was talking about before, you know, and that leads to opportunity when you recognize opportunity and go for it, you know. So, and Tommy, you know, Tommy was still to this day, he comes up with the most outrageous ideas, and you kind of look at him like, okay, you know, but there's one in there that's going to be shallow and deep at the same time, you know, and that's a mark of genius, really.
We had a year or two ago Chaz Bojorquez on the show, and he lives in Mount Washington, which is right next to that neighborhood. And he was talking about the way that, like, that neighborhood and its world, Northeast Los Angeles specifically, was how distinct it was from East L.A. and South L.A.
Yeah.
And he's like, you would never confuse it with Boyle Heights. Whole other thing, you know, whole other. For him, it was about graffiti styles and, you know, the gangs that they represented as well. But, like, each of those places, a whole other place. And like L.A. in the movies,
yeah,
it's the beach,
yeah, you go to Beverly
Hollywood,
Hills,
Beverly Hills.
Exactly.
And maybe you get a story about South or East L.A. that's about it, that's an awful tragedy about someone getting shot or whatever.
Yeah, it's my neighborhood. They were really just, but they were never portrayed on TV or any kind of media, with even writing. You know, the only media they were in was newspapers. The guy with a trunk open and a bale of hay in there, you know, and yeah, it was very distinct. But we kind of incorporated that intuitively as a representation of LA. It's like, I mean, it was meant to, there were certain aspects of our career and my career that were meant to be. And I just don't get in the way. That's the genius, that don't get in the way of something that is meant to be. When I moved to Canada, when I moved to Calgary, I moved into the exact neighborhood that Tommy Chong was born and raised in. And I started hearing stories about him because he was the most famous guy just before Cheech and Chong, when he was with Motown, to come out of there. So I don't know why I was gravitated towards that area, but it was. I was. And so I kind of trusted that, you know.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Cheech Marin. He's in the new films Champions and Shotgun Wedding. We were talking before we went on the air about my mom used to work at the Mexican Museum in San Francisco. And at the Mexican Museum, they had a lot of Mexican art.
Uh-huh.
That is art created by Mexicans in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And you've pretty much always focused on Chicano art, Mexican-American art.
Uh-huh.
Why was that?
Because it was something new.
I should say, as a collector, which
as a collector,
you're a pretty major collector.
You know, I knew about Western art. I was self-educated in that for a long time, and I other arts too. The gap in my knowledge artistically or art wise was contemporary art, and I knew some names. I knew up to modern art, but contemporary I didn't know. But I was married to a painter at the time, and she started taking me, Patty, to these contemporary galleries in Santa Monica and other places. And that's where I discovered these Chicano artists, Chaz Bojorquez being one of them, Carlos Almaraz and those four and those guys. And I recognized what it was right away. I could see the foundations and the influence that they created Chicano art, because all of these painters and these artists were art school and or university trained. They weren't naive, you know, hobbyist kind of. They were incorporating international elements all the time in their art. And I go, that's just, it's, you know what it was for me? It was like hearing the Beatles for the first time. You've heard this music before. There was Jerry Lee Lewis in there. There was Elvis. There was Fats Domino. But it was English, you know? And so it gave it this whole other spin. And that's what Chicano art did for me and these artists. This is world art, but it's Chicano. I saw where they were going. And so I said, well, I was a perfect storm. I knew what the art was. I had money to collect it. And I had a celebrity in order to proselytize for it eventually. And so I started buying the art, you know. And from as early as I can remember, I was a collector of something. Stamps, bottle caps, baseball cards, everything. I collect them all and get the whole set, you know, that mentality. And so I started buying. As soon as you buy one piece of Chicano art, all the Chicano artists know there's a live one out there. And so I got, and I was the only guy out there that was collecting on that scale. But the could collect big pieces, you know, 24 by 12 foot mural sized pieces. You're not going to put it over your couch or over your bedroom. You know, usually it goes to storage. But I was unique in that aspect, so I just kept going. And there was nobody else out there. You know, I wasn't battling other zillionaires for the latest piece of contemporary art.
So what was the first piece that you bought that, you know, got pride of place? What was the first thing that was like over your sofa or your mantelpiece? Well, like the one that you looked at every day, the first one that you looked at every day.
I bought a bunch of them at the same time, you know, and there was a big Carlos Almaraz car crash painting, the sunset crash. And it was, you know, I made various leaps in my purchasing power over the years. And okay, they want $20,000 for them. All right. And I leapt, you know, it was like I was the only guy out there buying Impressionist art when the Impressionists were like, I knew what it was. I knew what it was going to be. And that was the important. I knew what it was going to be because it was inevitable. This was great art.
Describe that picture for me.
The sunset crash is a car going off the freeway when they had bi-level freeways. One was higher, one was lower, and it's crashing on the freeway below in a fiery explosion. And I had seen that as a kid. There was, you know, the freeway that led out of downtown L.A. to like Whittier and Norwalk was one. And I saw cars go over that thing, and it scared the out of me when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, the fiery crash that could happen. And so every time we got on the freeway, I was saying every kind of rosary that you could, and please don't let that happen to me. And I was terrified, but it was alluring at the same time, you know, like, did you see that? Wow, that made a big explosion and blah. And it was like, and then I saw it represented in painting. I go, okay, this is not only my greatest fears and source of joy. I'll take this one. I'll go from spending $1,500 or $2,000 on a painting to $20,000, and it was a big leap.
Was it kind of weird and scary to think that you were like a show business guy that was in galleries buying art, like a fancy art dude?
Yeah, no, not at all. I felt right at home there. You know, I just like, because I was raised with art, unbeknownst to anybody. I was, you know, a lot of people, guys, you know, they get money and they buy the Ferrari or the Lamborghini or the, you know, whatever that is. I was never interested in cars, you know, but I was always interested in art. And so, this is something I can own that is really particular, you know, to me, and it hasn't had a big a showing anywhere. But it caught up really quick. You know, people started getting interested in it. So, and there was other collectors started to emerge. The big battle was getting into museums, you know, because the official attitude of museums was, oh, this is agitprop folk art, and so every artists that I told that to, that was the action, they always had the same reaction. What's agitprop folk art that I'm doing? Chas Bohorquez being one of them, man, you know, who was the inventor of graffiti art.
When you collect art, and you got more than you can put up in your house, or you just want to share it with people, you send it out places. You know, you call up the Dallas Museum of Art and say, would you like this Cezanne for a little while?
Yeah, that didn't happen. there was no other place to put it, it got put in storage. And so I started making friends in the art community, and I started showing them this collection. They said, well, this is a great collection. You got to show it. It doesn't do you no good under the bed or in the closet. You got to show it. Well, how do you do that? Well, you got to get a show and go to a museum. So, well, how do you do that? What are the? And
but so it's a lot of museums will not make a show of one person's stuff because theoretically that person could be doing that in order to get the stamp on the back of their picture from the, you know, SF MoMA and then sell it afterwards for more because it was exhibited at
SF MoMA. That was always the attitude. That was always the attitude. And my only argument against this was, well, I have this collection because you don't. And there wasn't any argument. there was no witty retort to that, you know. Well, okay. But when I put together a significant collection, I realized as well, if you want to put together a traveling show, you have to have sponsors. I mean, because it's a very expensive proposition. You know, I mean, everybody think, well, you just call the museum and they come in. That's a very expensive proposition. So I went around and started looking for sponsors. I was hooked up with a company called Evergreen in San Antonio, and they were doing big museum shows, but mostly kind of interactive natural history kind of stuff. And so we started going to every corporate headquarters in the United States, General Mills, General Motors, anything with a general in it. We were out there, you know, tap dancing. And eventually the Target stores and Hewlett Packard put together the seed money to make the first show. And then the Target store stayed with it because it was a perfect storm. You know, if Joe Blow had exactly the same collection and went to a museum, that's great, Joe Blow, but you know, how are we going to sell this? If Cheech Marin goes, a well-known name goes to the thing, it's a different story. They're still putting their heads in the block, which they don't want to do, the museum directors, because this is the official, like you say, imprimatur, like this really exists. This is a legitimate a school of art. And finally, the San Antonio Museum put their head in the block and the director, and it was a huge hit. But it was, but there was resistance from the Chicano community, the academic community, because, well, we love you as a comedian, but you know, who are you to come in and tell us what's what about Chicano art? That was not my purpose. My purpose was to share the art and to get everybody to see it, you know. And so once they started unloading the crates, the story changed.
We've got more to get into with Cheech Marin when we come back from a quick break. How do you get your own museum with your name on the front and everything? Well, Cheech Marin knows. He did it. He's living the dream. He'll tell us how it went down in just a minute. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at MassMutual.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Cheech Marin. He's a comedy legend, a legend in the art world, and of course, one of our workingest working actors. You've seen him in From Dusk Till Dawn, Spy Kids, Tin Cup. He's in two new movies right now, Champions and Shotgun Wedding. Let's get into the rest of my conversation with Cheech Marin. So there's now a museum named after you in Riverside that houses most of your collection. Did that really, like, go from being someone's idea to a museum in 5 years?
Yeah.
That is incredible.
It is incredible. It is even more incredible because I'd been doing shows, traveling shows before that, you know, but to have a permanent home for it, that came like the house out of the falling from the sky in The Wizard of Oz, you know. It just, what do you mean? I didn't understand what they wanted because I'd done a show at the Riverside Art Museum, which was, I think, Works on Paper from the collection. It was a big hit. It was the biggest show they had. And the town manager, city manager came and he says, I have this idea. We have this building, which is a beautiful mid-century building. It's right next door to the Mission Inn. It was the town library. And we're building a new library, so we have to repurpose this building. And we wanted to offer you the building for the collection. You give us a collection and we'll permanently house it there in the thing. And I didn't understand what they were talking about when they, you want me to buy a museum? I'm doing okay. I don't know if I'm museum rich, but you know, no. We want to give you the museum. Okay. And this is one of those examples again of there was an opportunity, the door opened. It's not going to stay open forever. You got to walk through. And this was a good collection that I had spent, you know, 40 years putting together. And I was going to give it to them. Walk through.
Did you immediately switch to collecting something else?
No.
I'm back on bottle caps.
You know, I recognized what it could be, you know, and it far exceeded my expectations. This year, we were just voted one of the top 50 museum shows in the world.
Now, I saw this gargantuan piece that is the, like, entryway piece for the museum. Uh-huh. Looks pretty incredible.
It is incredible.
Can you describe it for me?
It's a big lenticular piece by the brothers De La Torre, Einar and Jaimex De La Torre. And they are the perfect Chicanos, half Mexican, half San Diego, you know. They're my favorite kind of Chicano. They don't know they're Chicanos yet. And there's a bunch of them because it's a long trail but it's always the same source of inspiration, description of culture, you know, whether it's intimate moments or big public moments, but it's told in a thousand shades of brown, you know, this whole story, and it keeps continuing on to this day.
Lenticular means that's like sport flicks, baseball cards, yeah, or like those, or like prayer cards with the Virgin Mary on them.
Eyes of Jesus to follow you around, and it's a prismatic plastic basically that shifts the images shift as you move around the piece, and it's a huge. It's 26 by 13 feet, and it goes up through the second floor. We had to cut out the floor of the second story in order to fit this piece, and it's incredible.
What's depicted in this piece that's in the museum?
I couldn't tell you. There's so many images. The main image is there's a Aztec goddess, which is I can't even remember the name, has three X's in it, and the goddess of something or other, but it shifts.
You don't even have fluent Spanish, much less fluent Nahuatl or whatever.
No, exactly. Yeah, no, they told me the name, but I can't. And it shifts into like a Power Rangers thing. It represented the continuation of that influence but it's a huge piece and it has thousands of images in it. And they'd shift to another 1,000 images. And people are just like, and that's the first thing you see when you come into the museum is this big, gigantic, heretofore never seen way of art, you know? So it knocks people out as well as it should, you know, because it's spectacular.
Riverside is, I just typed it into the internet, it's 55% Latino.
Yeah.
What is the consequence of having a Chicano art museum in a place like that, that, you know, maybe had, I don't know. I went to the Bakersfield Art Museum one time. And there was a show of paintings of whales and they were nice enough. Mm. But like in a place where maybe they previously had a lot of shows of paintings of whales, yeah. What does it mean to have Carmen Lomascarza on the wall?
It is life-changing not only for the community, but for the museum culture in general. You know, this is the first Chicano museum dedicated solely to Chicano art. I experienced that feeling going to different places with the first show, Chicano Visions, that I put out. You go to Minneapolis, you know, it's not exactly the center of Chicanohood. You see them coming out of the woodwork, and the reaction was all of a sudden, where have all these people been? And for most of them, was the first time they'd been in a museum of any kind, you know, but because the mentality was that, this is not for us, you know, the stuff that we can't understand or it doesn't have pictures of saints in it or something, you know, but it really changed that. And it brought the community together in a very positive way, you know, because it's 50% Latino, as is the Inland Empire. So that's a big chunk of real estate, you know. So it gave them a source of pride, but also, hey, you know, hey, that guy Santana, he can really play that guitar. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, all of a sudden Santana meant rock and roll or rock or whatever that this thing was, you know, at that time.
There's a scene in Up in Smoke that I watched last night where you say your band plays all kinds of music from Santana to El Chicano.
You know everything. There again, shallow and deep at the same time. And I'm still, every day I realize that more and more, you know, that, how that was our aesthetic, you know, shallow and deep at the same time.
Do you think your artwork in museums would have the same impact if, rather than being Cheech Marin, famous Hollywood actor, famous for being chill and fun, or a beatific smiling dad.
Yeah.
You were like, I don't know. I was trying to think of a good example. Like Benjamin Bratt is from the neighborhood I grew up in, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he's Peruvian, I think.
Yes.
And like if it was Benjamin Bratt's museum, the guy who's famous for being handsome and cool and intense.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would have, if it would be as welcoming.
I don't know.
I mean, like, nothing against Benjamin Bratt, come on, bullseye.
Yeah.
But if you were a super intense, beautiful, famous dude, not that you're very beautiful.
This goes without saying.
Rather than a famous dude who's famous for being friendly.
Yeah.
I feel like it might be a different story.
I think it would be, you know, because, but I built up that reputation over a long period of time touring the collection. You know, at the point where we got to Riverside and they made this offer, we had played in over 50 museums, 50, from the Smithsonian on down. And for a museum culture that didn't want to do that, they didn't want to show private collections because I understand why. It usurps their curatorial power and blah, blah, blah. And who are you to set the standard? You don't have unpaid student loans. You know, you're not like one of us. And so it was a different, but the art spoke for itself at some point. You know, is that when I'm not kidding when I say the first, when in San Antonio, I was in the loading dock when they brought in the crates and started opening them. And that whole thing changed. And so there was a certain segment of Chicano students that were very political. They were being urged to be political. And Chicano art is only political and blah, blah, blah. And so they, even in the face of free tacos and tequila and beer, they were still rowdy, rowdy. And they confronted me at the opening of the show. And I said, okay. Anybody has anything to say tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I made it 9:30 to weed out most of the audience. Then 9:30, we're going to have an open forum here at the museum, and if anybody got anything to say, that's the time to say it. So we convened, and there was this big dais of you know, all the museum people and some artists and the audience. And the argument went back and forth, and what was and what wasn't Chicano art. And so finally this older lady who looked like she had seen everything Chicano in her life, and says, I have a question for John Valadez. And John Valadez was up there on the dais with me, and there's no more OG Chicano painter than John Valadez. I have a question for you. Considering everything you've heard today, do you still consider yourself a Chicano painter? And John looked up at the ceiling for a minute and says, only if it bothers you. That's my hero. That's my hero. He's gonna be my hero. Like that is Chicano. That is Chicano. And he expressed it perfect. What if it bothers you? And she said, "Yeah, okay, I get it." Sat down. But that is the Chicano intellectual debate.
Well, Cheech Marin, I sure appreciate you taking this time to be on the show. It's just I've always wanted to talk to you. It was really great to get to do it.
Thank you very much. It was my honor to be here. And everybody go down to Riverside and see The Cheech, which I got that name in as soon as I could. What should we call this thing? The Cheech. We have the Broad. How about The Cheech? Yeah.
Cheech Marin, everyone. You can catch him in the new film Champions. That's in theaters right now. He also was in the film Shotgun Wedding, which is streaming right now on Amazon Prime. His museum is in Riverside, California. It's called The Cheech. It features over 700 works of Chicano art, with more to come. You should go. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Things have been very busy here at my house, and I'll tell you why. It's because our company, Maximum Fun, is becoming a worker-owned cooperative. We're so proud. I'm so excited to become a worker owner. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Among my fellow worker owners-to-be are senior producer Kevin Ferguson and producers Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is by the great band The Go Team. The song's called Huddle Formation. Go check out The Go Team, thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us in all those places. Follow us. We will share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. The right agent can make or break your home search. That's why Homes.com provides an agent directory that details each agent's experience so you can find the right one and ultimately the right home. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.